first and foremost, let me say that it's been a real pleasure to be back at KITP and Santa Barbara, for which, since this is my last week here, I'd like to thank the organizers of both the programs that I've been privileged to take part in. This was a difficult year for me. I became, or had my arm twisted into becoming director of graduate studies. And since I'd never done this before, and this is the time that the economy tanked and Nassau Hall, our administration became distinctly unsympathetic to the idea of spending money on anything, this was a difficult year. So at the end of it, I felt I was in need of rest and recuperation. And so these two programs have actually worked out very nicely. The ADS-CMT program allowed me to rest because I would sit in these talks, all these wonderful things would go by, and I never said to myself, gee, I wish I could have done that. It's very relaxing. And the higher TC program has allowed me to recuperate.
You need more rest and relaxation.
Okay, all right. Now, I am recuperating, so what that means is that I've not actually been working in this area since I last thought about the Dunst effect and Long's experiments. But I think that's probably why I was asked to seed this discussion or nucleate it. So I view my job essentially as that of a bomb thrower, which is I'll make various outrageous comments, such as I made by mistake at lunch when our organizers were present. And hopefully, so first I'll go through all the bombs, if you don't mind, just hold your fire, and then we'll come back and you can take aim at each one of them, and that will generate a discussion. All right. So this is, I think, not a bomb yet. First, I almost stole it from Subir's paper, we stole it from Nigel Hussey's paper, then I thought I might as well steal it from the original source. It looks exactly the same. So we have our familiar phase diagram. We've got a doping axis, a temperature, and these different regimes, which we all know and love. And this is the area that we wish to focus on today. What you would have thought of before these compounds came along as the normal metallic state of some system of electrons, except that it has various odd properties. The temperature scale in a normal compound at which this regime terminates is 50 to 100 K, although, as we know with the application of the magnetic field, it's been possible to probe that lower in selected cases. And it goes up by different measures to, say, 1,000 Kelvin if you're thinking of DC resistivity, and maybe something like 3,000 Kelvin if you're thinking of the optical response. And the defining characteristic is that there are certain objects, in particular the resistivities, which show a linear, particularly simple power law dependence over that range. And this is not the dependence that you would expect if you had a Fermi liquid, which would be your standard explanation for power laws in the normal state, and hence it's a marginal Fermi liquid or simply a strange metal. It's not enough that the power laws are linear. It's also a statement that the resistivity goes past the so-called Joffe-Rigel limit, which is where any explanation in terms of quasi-particles ought to cease. All right, good. Now, what are the facts in need of explanation? Okay. So I would claim that the facts are as follows. From photoemission, we know that there is something like a Fermi surface. If I think of it as a locus of low energy, single particle-like excitations, or at least these are big and fat, but something, some low energy excitations. So there is a Fermi surface in this region, but without quasi-particles, or more precisely, since we're not going all the way down to zero temperature, without the Fermi liquid scaling of the properties of quasi-particles, widths, and so on. Now, something for which there is evidence is that this is a Fermi surface, but that the lifetimes are, in fact, anisotropic as you go around the Fermi surface. And you might even fret if you were thinking of this as, you know, representing some sort of power law behavior, that you might even have different powers at different points on the Fermi surface. I don't know that there's any experimental data decisively one way or the other. We're only talking about a decade in temperature. If somebody knows, they can comment on that. But certainly gross features are different, say, in the nodal direction and the antinodal direction as you come down. The power laws in transport are the chief magnet drawing people to explanations of this thing. So the linear resistivity is remarkable. And It's worth noting, though, that there are different ranges for the longitudinal Hall response. This may go up to 1,000 Kelvin, but this may only go up to half of that. And again, you know, factors of two. Maybe you don't want to take them too seriously, but they're worth bearing in mind. I would also say that there's nothing dramatic in low-frequency susceptibilities that correlates with transport scaling and temperature. So in other words, if you ask someone why do they think it's quantum critical, they rule out the resistivity. They don't give you some antiparamagnetic correlation, some charge density wave correlation, some susceptibility which you would identify with order as showing clear evidence of quantum critical growth over that same range of temperatures. Obviously, it's not the lowest frequency because you do have a temperature in there, but that's okay. On the other hand, in different parts of the phase diagram, although not in really at optimal doping, but if we are generous and we give nail temperatures, put nail temperatures in the list too, there are various instabilities, actually quite a list of them by now, not all of which will presumably go away upon careful experimental work. Obviously, antiferromagnetism, incommensurate antiferromagnetism, there's even evidence for time reversal breaking, pneumatic ordering. So there's really quite a list by now of things that happen as you come down. The thermodynamics is featureless. I don't think there's anything terribly interesting by way of a singularity. Okay, all right, good. So these I would say are the sort of central facts you want to try and understand. Now, we can do two explanations, and I'll call them top-down and bottom-up. And this is in the spirit not of in the spirit of this phase diagram. We can start there and make our way down, or we can start here and make our way up. So top-down, you would say to yourself, let me take something like a Hubbard model, right? And let me start at the bandwidth where I have some idea what the problem looks like. It's got a kinetic energy. It's got a repulsion, which is essentially instantaneous, some Hubbard U. And then I'll start carrying on an exact RG. And I want to move towards this Fermi surface that I claim is there. Okay? So since it's a locus of low energy excitations, the natural RG ought to be one where you scale towards it. So that's what I'm going to do. And what I would like to do in this way of thinking about it is that I would hope that as I do this procedure, by the time I get down to 1,000 Kelvin or 3,000 Kelvin, I've arrived pretty close to some unstable fixed point. So the spirit of this exercise, of course, is exactly the spirit of our canonical explanation in terms of Fermi liquid theory. We begin at the bandwidth. We have some weak interactions and some Debye frequency, say an electron-phonon superconductor. We scale from the Fermi energy down towards the Debye frequency. We get rid of most stuff except Landau parameters. And when we get to that, then we say, aha, we've got phonons, stick those in, and eventually we get our superconducting order. Right? So it's an unstable fixed point. The Fermi liquid is an unstable fixed point that we're looking for. One point to make is that in this kind of a scenario, if you think again back to the Fermi liquid case, the way you parameterize the Fermi liquid fixed point in terms of Landau functions and stuff has nothing obviously to do with the superconducting order. You know, you don't have a superconducting order parameter in your description. Instead, you have n of k. Yes, it has a superconducting instability, but one feature, it seems to me, of a top-down explanation might be that the parameterization of the fixed point is somehow in terms of things that you wouldn't recognize as fluctuating order parameters down at a lower temperature. Okay, so now this unstable fixed point that we'd like to find, I think it has to be building up somehow singular in momentum space or retarded couplings corresponding to singularities in frequency. Because if you get analytic couplings, then eventually your cutoff is small, and then you're back to classic Fermi liquid behavior because phase-space constraints will kill you off. So as you run this RG, something ought to be building up to what looks like singular behavior. And I'd also like it to contain multiple growing susceptibilities because eventually you'd like to understand these various things that can happen. Okay. The other thing is it would be nice if this meant that this existed not just in this one compound, right? Because if it's going to be some more general explanation, it ought to be something that you can find in other strongly correlated materials. And also you'd like to somehow understand this doping-dependent termination in some natural way. For Fermi liquids, this is not a big deal. It's true that when you put in the details of band structure, you know, you get stuff, but on the whole, the Fermi liquid, you know, one Fermi surface is as good as any other Fermi surface if you wish to understand sort of the basics of it. So exactly how that comes in, I don't. I would maybe say that we heard from Mark a very nice summary of, you know, DMFT-based techniques, which show evidence of what looks like a strange metal. And I would say that they're probably producing growing retardation. They're basically frequency guys. And presumably, some of the normal state behavior is already there in the single site model. Is that a fair statement? You don't really need to get the Luckett in order to get the normal state behavior. That's more important for D-wave superconductivity.
Some of it's there.
Right.
So it may be trivial.
Right.
But if you go up to higher temperatures than in the single site model, right, higher temperatures than the Kondo scale, you do see linear resistivity. And the slope of the linear resistivity changes like 1 over the dopant.
I take that to mean that a frequency, a momentum-independent self-energy, right, is already giving us that behavior from there. So it's somehow a case of the singularities being developed are a result of starting with a non-retarded interaction and flowing to a retarded interaction. So I don't know if it's possible somehow to import RG into DMFT and actually somehow make that into a statement you can get your hands on. I would say that a stable phase would probably be too much. So Matthew Fisher gave us a talk at the conference on a D-wave Bose liquid, which is, he's thinking of this as a possible explanation for the strange metal. I would say that if you actually produced a phase at zero temperature, which is stable over some range, then you're sort of stuck explaining why you get, somehow then it's too stable. And I think given the phase diagram, you want something which is at least unstable. Otherwise,
well, the one out of that we could say about the real stable phase at zero temperature is superconductivity, so you don't really care.
Right.
And maybe this phase is stable only in somewhere other portion of the phase diagram, but nevertheless it's important.
I understand, but then it somehow, it takes away some of the appeal of making it stable in the first place, because then you have to find a place where it's unstable. But
okay.
Sure, I don't disagree with that. But okay.
If
all right.
Stable phase, then you maybe should have seen it somewhere else.
That, yeah. Right.
Well, yes, yeah. You should see it, but we don't have 60 tests.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
You can study all the
right
compounds.
All of it. That's indeed possible.
All those things.
No, but if it's unstable to superconductivity, then it's not stable.
Well, everything is unstable.
No. He's imagining something which is really, really stable. Okay, so this is a sort of discussion we actually come back to. All right. The bottom-up explanation is, of course, that somewhere there's a quantum critical point at zero temperature between some phases, which leads to a quantum critical funnel and maybe hidden by a superconducting dome. And once theorists see a quantum critical funnel, they tend to get sucked into it. This reminds me of this terrific joke, which unfortunately I don't have a version of that yet for quantum criticality, which Tom Halsey made. So he was, like me, Tom was a fellow who believes that you should never let your career stand in the way of a good joke. So Pierre Bach came to give a talk on self-organized criticality, and Tom apparently stood up and said, "The problem with the field of self-organized criticality is a lack of organized self-criticality." And Tom... All right. First prize to whoever works out the quantum version of that. Okay. So anyway, what do we need here? So one thing I would say is that, look, if you want to explain this resistivity, you sort of need criticality over most of the Fermi surface. Otherwise, you have this sort of well-known problem that if you have some hot spots, some spots where there's lots of scattering, where you're going to get, I think Maurice and Lubina pointed this out a long time back, where you're going to get, sort of non-Fermi liquid behavior, that will end up being shorted out by cold spots where you do have Fermi liquid behavior in the Fermi surface. So you really want most of the Fermi surface, or maybe all of it, to be doing something odd.
Sorry.
Okay. Please. And I know. In fact, I'm looking. Since I saw in your article you said this can be done, so I'm looking forward to it.
I'm just referring to other people.
Yeah, I understand. That was the Roche paper. I didn't get around to looking at it. Right. So that's a prejudice I just expressed. I think we would then, if you have a Fermi surface which was mostly critical, you'd want to understand why there's a single power. Since if you have a whole Fermi surface going critical, there's no particular reason that you couldn't imagine different powers at different points in the Fermi surface. Also, if you have a Sabaze-like scenario going between two Fermi surfaces and you buy this, then in the critical region, you have one Fermi surface giving way to the other, then both of them would have to be substantially critical over most of them. So in fact, in the marginal region, I would expect to see ghosts of two Fermi surfaces and not just one. But this is all in the spirit of bomb throwing. Did everybody else follow that point? Because I was rushing through it so Subir wouldn't complain, but maybe that's not fair.
No, try
again. Okay. So you've got a big Fermi surface and a small Fermi surface, right? Now you want to match them. So at the critical point, somehow both have to be present. Now, if you're simply doing hotspots, then what you do is you've got maybe points where you're going to open a gap. Yeah, I suppose. I won't be able to draw it, though, so that's the trouble.
So I think, turn the light off.
Right. So, you know, you want to go from this to maybe, you know, that or something like that, right? So you've got multiple copies, but then if you superpose them, but then you open a gap in two places, which is going to separate bits. So as long as you're only doing points, that's fine, because you come to the one Fermi surface comes, then you start to scatter and open a gap, and then you go over into this one. But if you're imagining that both of these Fermi surfaces are going critical at the same place, because you've decided in advance that you want the entire Fermi surface to go critical in order to get the linear resistivity, then both of them have to be present at the critical point, because the critical point always knows something about both phases. So you sort of have these two ghosts present at that point.
I get 5 minutes at some time.
Yeah. In fact, I think from 5...
What a great interaction.
6 to 7 is all yours. Yeah. Okay. Now, if you buy this logic that you do want a critical Fermi surface, then you want fluctuations at small momentum, because otherwise you're only coupling certain spots in the Fermi surface. And the candidates for that sort of stuff are spin chirality, maybe pneumatic order, phase fluctuations. These are all things of the superconducting order parameter, which have the ability to produce that. But in all of this, you would do all of that, and then you still have to explain why the susceptibilities are modest, and also the susceptibilities are modest, and yet you are at temperatures where corrections to scaling are exceedingly modest. You get this very nice linear fit. And even in the choice of scaling variables, you've got a temperature going up. If you think about it, unless there's an exact symmetry, some sort of duality relating the two phases, there's no reason for the line on which you get very, very nice power laws to be, nonlinear scaling variable to be exactly the temperature in the theory of classical critical phenomena. This stuff was worked out by Wegener. I don't think the analogous thing has been done in the quantum critical problem, but it could be done. And one would be left with something to understand. Okay, so I think that was my list. Maybe, shall I just go back to item one, and if people have something to say there, then we'll just go through comments step by step?
There are other options.
Other options?
For linear thing.
Okay, so which way do you want to do this? Anybody disagree with the facts in need of explanation, or?
I think your idea of going now down through people having a chance to
talk.
Yeah, but there's also the option that there's an entire phase that has no examples.
Okay. But, as an organizer, you have to listen to your fellow organizers. Do you agree with the facts? Are these facts and things we're all agreed on? Other facts?
Other facts.
What I'm saying is that there, as a fact is that there are systems like on the side.
Very good.
Where there is an entire phase that has linear resistivity, and it's hard to imagine.
No. It's not. That's why it's teaching that it's in packs.
No, it's linear too, in the as a function of person.
No, it's linear. It's a non-Fermi liquid power law, but
yeah.
It's
not linear, yeah.
Well, there is the some of the Ruthenates, the one I know best.
Yes.
The 113, the simple cross-track Ruthenate, which is certainly pretty linear indeed. It's a ferromagnet. Mm-hmm. So you come down, you see this linear stuff, you see the ferromagnetism, and as we now, Tammy McKenzie showed, it's certainly a Fermi liquid down below. Mm-hmm. So there's ferromagnetism, this, and the, we call it the optical conductivity is non-Brillouin. Mm-hmm. It's got a relaxation time proportional frequency. Mm-hmm. So it has the canonical properties of the linear resistivity stuff. And so I think just for the spin theory folks, it's not just the cooperates and superconductivity.
So let me ask a slightly sharper question. So in that case, if you're attributing it to ferromagnetic fluctuations, does the linear behavior persist to the scale of the J of the paramagnet? I think the thing which is very...
It's up to 800 degrees.
And in strontium-ruthenate, not that one, the P-wave superconductor, the 214, they've tracked the linear resistivity up to 1,400 Kelvin.
Yeah, but what limits it is decomposition, not a failure to go linear.
Okay,
the point I wanted to make that has theoretical content, but may have theoretical content, you don't want an explanation. I mean, there has to be some generic explanation for this, or it's not as interesting as the one. So be careful with, I would object to and did object to Matthew's D-wave goes on. That's not obviously going to work in these other systems. Mm-hmm. Just so that people know, this is more common, not restricted to the cooperate.
Okay.
Along the same lines, there's a cooperate by Louis Taillefer.
Okay.
Some of you know about. which I just pulled up. So we oppose linear resistivity on the border of spin density wave order in the organic superconductors and also the nictides. And here, and which are both quasi-two-dimensional in some sense. And he has a very, the main point of the paper is an interesting correlation between the resistivity, the slope, and TC. So if you say rho is AT, right, resistivity is rho is AT. His claim is that A is proportional to TC with the same rough constant across many materials.
There are certainly, I mean, if, you know, it depends what we look for, but if we look for a roughly T-linear resistivity that goes up to values bigger than the Ophi-Regel limit, TTF-TCNQ has that. TTF-TCNQ is a quasi-one-dimensional material with a CDW instability at low temperature. Strontium ruthenate that Mac mentioned is a nearly cubic material with a ferromagnetic ground state. Strontium ruthenate that I mentioned is also a quasi-two-dimensional material, but with multiple bands at the Fermi surface, not just one, which has no magnetism in it at all, but is a P-wave superconductor at low temperature.
And that has been open up to where?
Strontium ruthenate, 1400 kelvin. The quasi-two-dimensional one has.
So in these cases, is there some specific carrier concentration or just?
So that's a stoichiometric compound, so it's a line compound. I don't know what happens as a function of
the Tegel sort of also a practically linear resistivity above the crossover temperature to 2D3. As far as we can see.
Morris, it's not from strontium ruthenate, when you say there's no magnetism, you actually have to be a little more careful. The one-dimensional parts of the two one-dimensional things are highly nesting and shows a very substantial anti-paramagnetic
fluctuations. I agree with you. It's just that there isn't an ordered state.
No, there isn't an ordered state.
And, you know, they're messier materials, but in fact, K3C60 shows a linear temperature dependence in its normal state up to 500 Kelvin.
There's another.
Some of the heavy fermions.
Yeah, but those I think have much lower resistances. I mean, you know, one of the troubles is that, you know, lead and copper also have a T-linear resistance, but that's due to electron phonon coupling, and that's at a value, much, much smaller value, and so that's presumably a different phenomenon.
There's also this, you see it in the cuprates, and as I showed last week, in the bisulfates, the density of states near the potential. Is linear and asymmetric. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know that that's been looked at in all of, or I'm sure it hasn't been looked at in all of these cases that are being assessed, but that is there. And also in the case of the bismuth phase, as I showed last week, Dine showed that the TC is of the superconductor is related, or at least correlates linearly with the size of that slope. So, that sounds.
That's although sounds a lot like what Subir was just saying.
It does sound
like
that's what they reminded me of.
He's specifically looking at the point where the spin density wave order disappears and all
of
these.
Okay.
I see. The question is whether this behavior is necessarily related to some.
Well, not quite, but at this one in particular, where there's is it various different kinds of order, I think was the point that Steve was trying to make, in which cases, in which case you would be hard put to necessarily pin it on a quantum critical point of a particular. And so I think I'm taking away from this that there's at least the linear resistivity violating the Ophi-Regel limit exists in several different materials.
Quasi 1D material theory, does it violate
well
above the
Ophi-Regel? I think it goes above the
I'm sorry,
quasi 1D is not strictly linear, it's not T, it's not a beautiful linear law, it's T to the power 1.1 or 1.2.
You also have to be a little careful with that. In TTF-TCNQ at least, I know that originally it was thought to be nonlinear, but there's also thermal expanse.
I know, so here they did make the mistake that they thought it was T square.
Yeah.
So Fermi liquid all over the place, and then they realized that there was a linear regime that one can reasonably attribute to the 1D behavior.
Yeah.
So this was taken care of.
If we're still collecting facts, I wanted to add the fact of emission that there doesn't seem to be any indication of scattering from phonons showing up.
Sorry, I'm very glad you brought that up. I forgot totally, which is there are all these phonons along the way, and you go past them and you never see them. Absolutely.
Yes, that's true.
Absolutely. It was part of my prep, but I forgot.
That's right.
Incident of the phonon not barking in the night.
So, can we know a little bit about anything? The other people, do you know more about what happens with photo emission in this regime of space metallism for the Fermi surface?
Yeah, has anybody looked seriously at anisotropic lifetimes? And
yes, I will talk tomorrow about, in the next slide you have, you talked about doing ORG.
Right.
We have been doing ORG for two-dimensional functional ORG. Karsten Honecker and Manfred for some years.
So the only reason I didn't, that's weak coupling, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
okay,
yeah,
I'm going to talk about it tomorrow.
Yeah.
But of course, because it's one loop, we are limited to moderate values of U.
Mm-hmm.
But we have recently gone back, motivated by these experiments,
mm-hmm.
and what we find is that as you approach from what you produce the doping from in the open region, you do find a dramatic rise in the scattering vertex, which especially it becomes strongly angular dependent around the Fermi surface, especially by connecting the antimodal points. And if you simply do the simplest approximation to calculate the scattering rate, inelastic scattering rate, because the vertex is rising something like the square root of t, you get a factor of one of the t, which cancels one factor of the t squared standard Landau theory.
Mm-hmm.
So you can explain the anisotropy that Hussey gets, and also it looks in certain density range approximately linear, of course.
So if I understood you correctly,
calculations, I understand.
So there are points at which you get linear in T width, and other points where you get T squared.
Yeah, linear in T term grows around the frames.
But this is in the Fermi liquid, in the what he was calling the Fermi liquid regime.
This is
at low temperature on the overdoped side.
Okay. No. So what I want to know is, for instance, in the photo emission experiments, has anybody ever taken widths, EDCs, MDCs, whatever, plotted as functions of angle, functions of temperature, different angles?
In the strange matter.
In the strange matter.
Yes.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Yes. And it always looks like it's linear.
So. My memory, you certainly still see the Fermi surface, for instance.
Right.
If you look at low energy
mm-hmm.
in that regime, you see the locus of points that you've been talking
right.
about. But if you look at EDCs, mm-hmm. that is to say, if you sit, say, near the Fermi momentum and look at the distribution as a function of energy,
mm-hmm.
you see a peak. If you're along the nodal direction, you see a peak whose width is comparable to its energy.
Mm-hmm.
In the antinodal regions, you don't see a peak.
Okay.
But there are also problems if you include scattering, as I think Peter and I and others found. If you simply put in scattering.
From disorder, you mean?
From disorder. It depends where they are and whether you're talking about going actually superconducting.
No, he's talking about in the strange metal regime, so where there's no pseudo gap.
And the results from photo emission you're referring to are at high energies, right? So presumably disorder is not playing a role.
Yeah.
Right? The 1 over tau of the nodal quasi particle is linear in omega.
Yeah.
There's also in the overdoped regime, the full Fermi surface, which agrees with LVA, has been measured by quantum oscillations.
Yeah, but he was asking in the strange metal regime.
Yeah.
In the strange metal regime, so that's at high temperature and near optimal doping.
So you could imagine that on the Fermi surface, right, you've got some lifetime which actually, even a power, 1 over tau, goes as t to some power, which actually depends on where you are on the Fermi surface, right?
In a, that was something like that.
Right.
Right.
That's right. So the question is, you know, it's a question which is now posed in theory, and then, you know, is there any reason to think one way or the other? Now, it's obviously difficult to tell. It's hard enough to tell one power over a decade, to tell differences in powers. And if stuff disappears altogether, that's encouraging, but makes it, again, hard to measure the power.
Yeah, and it's also, right. You know, it's also not completely clear whether, you know, the Fermi velocity is also weaker in the antinodal regimes, and so, you know, resolution and all sorts of other stuff,
right.
You know, there may be non-intrinsic reasons for losing the peak there.
Right. Okay, so I think that's on the Fermi surface. Yeah, yeah.
They said nothing dramatic. What about the anomalous neural state?
Well, the thing is, you know, so the question of where you want to sit, which is, first of all, in the, you know, the NERN stuff is sort of here, right? And superconducting fluctuations, which you can seriously attribute to super, you know, sort of go up maybe to, I don't know, YVCO, you know, 3DXY behavior we've seen up to some. But you're going up to 1,000. You don't see them past, you know, 200. So it's, and the NERN stuff is a superconducting fluctuation effect. You don't see it. But basically, those are just linear fits,
yeah,
right? Okay.
Yeah,
this is a different point.
Yeah, like
okay. This is linear in Omega.
Oh, this is linear in.
Can you connect the computer?
What are we looking at? Is there a paper I can bring up?
Yeah, this is.
That's maybe easier.
Peter Johnson's paper.
I could, but my computer may. Okay. It doesn't matter as long as you don't want to get back to my computer, we're fine. We'll just. It's temperamental. It's been known to. All right. Oh, there we go. Okay. Now what happened? Sorry. Old-fashioned problem. Yeah. All right. So momentum widths as a function of temperature for different positions on the Fermi surface. Okay.
These are MDC widths.
Right, right.
These are 100 to 300.
Right.
The momentum is huge.
So basically, in here. Or I don't know. Who's the, this is
Diana. You can just change the page.
Switch up. Oh no, it's in French.
It's a French arrow.
Okay. This is why I didn't want to change my computer.
Wait, go back one.
Okay. Just which one?
No, here? The EDCs. I just wanted to show what I said about the EDCs.
Here?
Yeah, there.
Yeah. So you can see that. At 100 and something Kelvin, there's no real peak.
Yeah.
It's
there's
not
valid
at all.
Yeah.
There, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Except in the nodal region, you can see there is still a little something.
Okay. Right. Good. All right. Let's see if we can get this back. Okay. So where were we? So I think that, so for photo emission, I think that was one question. Transport, I don't think, phonons we added. What about nothing dramatic and low frequency susceptibilities? Would anybody like to take issue with that, such as Subir? Since eventually you'll be asked why you don't produce susceptibilities which are dramatic, but you maybe answer that.
Well, I mean, I gave the talk on that, and I guess the scenario there was when you actually...
No, experimentally, would you agree with this claim? Would you say that's fair?
In the strange metal.
In the strange metal? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, above
QC. Above QC, nothing. All right, good. We're done? The facts are on the table?
Maybe another way to ask this question is, can we tell the difference between having a linear T behavior or a linear T phase, a strange metal phase, that comes from quantum verticality from something that doesn't.
Okay, so this is theory. We'll turn to theory. All right. So now, actually, since Subir's been very patient, maybe we'll do the bottom-up explanation before we do the top-down. How's that? Okay. Your floor is all yours. Complain away.
Can I go on to the board and take 5 minutes?
Hook up your computer.
Six or seven.
Well.
Take your seat.
I'm not claiming to have an explanation, but right. I just want to.
Would you like to be recorded?
Quick summary of a paper that we've contacted.
It's going to be
7 minutes later. Then.
Oh, it has been recorded.
Okay, so the question we were addressing is try to get some idea of how you go from what's known as the large Fermi surface state at high doping, which, as Morris mentioned, is seen in photo emission and quantum oscillations in a variety of compounds. And then certainly in the ordered antiferromagnet at very low doping or at high fields, there's evidence for pockets, both in the electron and the whole doped superconductor. So you see hole pockets here. And then there's also claim that in some cases that you've got electron pockets sitting over here. Although we don't know where they are, but because there isn't any direct photo emission evidence for them, but certainly from quantum oscillations, there's a claim of electron pockets. Anyway, I don't want to go into those controversies. The question we wanted to think about was exactly how do you go from one to the other, and does this have anything to do with the strange metal criticality?
And the resistivity question, if you'll address that.
I won't address it, but I'm going to, we have a framework for a theory that hopefully we could solve. Will luckily also solve that problem. So one easy way to go from here to here is the so-called Hertz theory, which is just fluctuations about standard spin density wave theory, which I briefly reviewed in my talk also. There's the idea there is that you have some order parameter. Let's take a spin density wave order parameter at wave vector pi pi. And so what that's going to do is shift this Fermi surface by pi pi, and so we get some shifted Fermi surface. That's going to take yellow here. So this is the same Fermi surface which has been shifted by pi pi, and so fermions in the unshifted momentum will couple to the fermion that's shifted momentum at the same point of the Boolean zone. So just a way of graphically seeing where the fermions couple to each other. And the coupling is strongest right here. And so eventually you'll open up gaps when the coupling turns on. And so that gives you a quantum critical point from this so-called large Fermi state, subsurface state, to a Fermi pocket state. So what we've been studying is the possibility of undergoing this transition in somewhat more exotic ways. And to do that, we found that the most general way to do it, it'll be explained in the paper if you want to read about it, you can formulate the whole problem in terms of an SU2 gauge theory. And what we found in the end, the gauge theory allows for some more exotic phases that I'll mention in a minute. But somewhat to our surprise, we found that it also allows for a direct transition, which is basically in the Hertz class. So despite introducing all kinds of gauge fields and fractionalization and so on, in the end, when we find a direct transition between these states, the theory for it is as formulated by Hertz, just in terms of an order parameter, and you look at its fluctuation and its damping due to the Fermi surface excitation.
Subir, just to make sure, this state is an antiferromagnetic metal on the left.
That's correct. Yeah, so these are both Fermi liquid phases with Fermi liquid behavior. And so one possibility is that this critical point is somehow controlling the stained metal. We don't know that. The theory of this in two dimensions is still quite open. Abanov and Chubukov pointed out that there's an infinite number of marginal operators about the Hertz free energy. He only wrote down the leading one, but there's actually an infinite number of them. And we don't really know how to properly sum them. It's just totally open. So there is a possibility that it's just this critical theory written down 30 years ago is going to be the thing we need to understand completely to understand the strain metal. But we don't know that, of course.
So,
yeah.
So is it, what's clear to me,
yeah,
is
the energy reach or the temperature
right.
reach
sure.
or something like this. I just want to have a picture of how high up we can expect this behavior to be going on when
right.
when we perhaps don't see experimentally or maybe
yeah.
don't see in the Monte Carlo indications of some sort of fluctuations becoming stronger.
Right, you would,
you
may not expect at the critical point any gaps opening at these points. Those in fact, totally absent in the Hertz theory. But you would expect some spin susceptibility, say neutron scattering, to be significantly large. Now, you know, one way out of it is, well, the spin susceptibility is slowly increasing, but not very much. And once you go superconducting, as I argued in my talk last week, the critical point gets pulled out from under you to a lower doping, so it eventually never, you never see it, except in high magnetic fields.
So maybe one's fine, or maybe uncomfortable below 200, 250 Kelvin or something.
Okay.
But somehow when I go up...
Yeah, there, no, I agree, that's...
600, and we know that
sure.
the Monte Carlo is running,
right.
and we know the correlation length is
mm-hmm.
lattice spacing, more or less.
Right.
It's hard to see how it's continuing to have this behavior.
I agree with you. I think that is perfectly a legitimate question. All I'm saying is that at the very least, as theorists, we should figure out what's going on here. And it's still an open problem. And, you know, we'll see at that point with this.
I haven't
finished my story yet, but anyway.
So supposing the superconducting thing was gone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So these points.
Yeah.
Crossed,
right.
Should show some distinguished behavior in temperature as you come down to zero temperature.
Absolutely. Yes. It depends where you're coming down. I mean, right at the critical point. Yeah, I think that's correct.
So the lifetime there. Now you say, despite this hotspot, cold spot intuition is wrong, and you don't have.
No. So that would to detect that you don't have to see that in photo emission, or.
That's right. But why doesn't that also tell you that in transport you would be dominated by the Fermi surface parts of the Fermi liquid parts of the Fermi surface?
I guess this is you have to look at equilibration around the surface with small amounts of disorder, and when you do that in the simplest Boltzmann equation calculation that Roche did, you found over some regime of linear resistance. But it requires some disorder to re-equilibrate different points on the Fermi surface.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. At least the canonical wisdom is that the transport is dominated by the near nodal. Direction quasi-particles, which are...
How do you know that?
Well, so I think the main reason people have concluded that, first place from band structure, that's where the mass is lightest, or the Fermi velocity
mm-hmm.
is
okay.
lightest.
Yeah.
But also, as you go through pseudo-gap,
mm-hmm.
which gaps the portion of the Fermi surface near the antinodes,
right.
there's almost no change in the in-plane resistivity, whereas
okay.
the out-of-plane
okay.
Okay. resistivity and optical conductivity, which
right.
is supposed to be dominated by the antinodes, changes
mm-hmm.
dramatically.
Uh-huh.
So at least there, by opening the pseudo gap in the antinodes, it doesn't affect the in-plane transport. That's at least a moderate.
That's an interesting point. Okay, right. Okay, so there are cousins of this kind of critical point, like the pneumatic, which I won't discuss now, but for which you could talk about the same issue, and then this problem wouldn't be there, I suppose. Another interesting question is, you know, you've got a spin density wave order parameter, which is presumably is a complex vector, both in the x and the y direction, and it may well be when you fully solve this theory that the pneumatic fluctuations are very strong. We don't know. It's still a strongly coupled theory of these two complex overdamped order parameters with an infinite number of marginal operators, so who knows? But you can imagine fixing it up in this, at least in the Landau-Ginzburg framework, and various routes to fixing these problems. But yeah, those are all open, interesting open questions. But yeah, certainly I think it's about time that we looked at this problem much more carefully than it has been done. Well, many people have, but it's still outstanding. And the cousins of it with the pneumatic order parameter. Anyway, so our purpose was in fact in this analysis was to motivate originally by photo emission experiment that seemed to be showing some pocket-like or Fermi arc-like structure at finite temperature. So we were asking, are there exotic phases in which these pockets could survive even at zero temperature, and exactly how would those phases relate to these two Fermi liquid states. So in this gauge theory that we have of formulating everything, first of all, we reproduce this Hertz transition. We found two new phases that could be in between. And they are similar to the phases that Shivaji mentioned. And so what you find here is a non-Fermi liquid phase, which has the large Fermi surface, but I'll draw it in a fuzzy way. It's fuzzy everywhere. So it's a, or some language, it's a critical Fermi surface, it's lifetime. It's something like omega to the 2/3, we don't know, but it's described by an SU2 gauge field, gauge, coupled to a Fermi surface. So this has been roughly, if you took SU3 and you took, well, at least in the simplest perturbative, if you took this problem for SU3 and had three species of quarks, this is the problem of quark matter at very high density that Krishna gave a very beautiful summary of a couple of weeks ago. This is in two dimensions, it's SU2 and there's only one, well, there's two Fermi surfaces spin up and down, roughly speaking. So there is an exotic state like this, and there's a even more exotic phase transition, and then there's another exotic phase here where you get, again, fuzzy Fermi surfaces, but only on the pockets. Okay. So this is certainly a more preferred state for talking about the strange metal, because it, I don't think there's any evidence of strange metal of behavior like this. But so there is a possible phase here which has no obvious order parameter, which can occur in between these two states as an alternate route. And we understand almost nothing about it.
Yeah. That SU2 phase, right?
Yeah.
It has three gauge fields.
That's correct.
What are they physically? What fluctuations do they represent?
Well, so they are connected at some level to the spin density wave order parameter. There's some fractionalized version of it. So one way to think about it, well, let's see.
One, I know how to make a kind
of sorry. The way to think about it that you have here, you think of these pockets as sitting in the background of a spin density wave order parameter. So when you allow the spin density wave to fluctuate, then there's a SU2, there's a spin SU2 degree of freedom telling you which direction the spin density wave is fluctuating. And this gauge field, in a way, is a connection of that. So it's telling you something about the fluxes associated with having different spin polarization at different sites, local spin density wave order. In a way, and the local amplitude, however, the spin density wave is also fluctuating strongly. If the local amplitude is, so if you have only angular fluctuation of the spin density wave order, then you get this fuzzy phase, where locally they're pockets, but they're fuzzy because eventually you're restoring long range. I mean, locally you have a pocket. They're fuzzy because, yeah, you're restoring long-range order, and it's still a non-Fermi liquid phase with no, it's a topological non-Fermi liquid phase. Here, even the amplitude is fluctuating strongly enough that you lose the pockets. But you are building things out of the order parameters you had available to you. That is important. So it gives you an out, in a sense, because you're using the, say, I mean, the thought here would be, well, you do see some order parameters at low temperatures. Let's take them, and you normalize them a little bit. So that gives you some guidance as to other kind of more topological phases you might find. And perhaps those will exist over longer, broader temperatures.
So since you have 2 minutes time, even though this corrected, it has an entire, as a function of pressure, it has an entire phase of these numbers.
Right.
Where the helix appears to be at least partially melted.
That's right. So I think this formalism could be very useful there. And I'm
heavily reminiscent to this idea.
If you wish, yeah. It's a fluctuating spin density wave state in all directions. And I think, you know, I've been thinking about it for years, and I'm very happy that I found a simple, well, me and my students have found a simple way of doing the whole thing. And in a transparent way, I hope you'll agree, when you see the paper. And maybe it can be transferred to MNSI. Certainly be delighted if that happens.
So with that in mind, suppose you calculate the spin-spin correlation function.
It has some finite correlation. It's not going to diverge.
It doesn't have power law. It's got a finite correlation
line. That's right. It doesn't have a power law. The spin doesn't. The charge has various power laws, not the spin. Yeah. The spins, that's correct. So in fact, this phase, if you found at zero temperature, would have a spin gap. Of course, at finite temperature, everything is exponential.
Where the spin pneumatic, where the parameters are more exotic like that?
Spin pneumatic.
It's possible the spin-spin correlation function maybe should range, but
those are conventional auto parameters in a sense. They're not topological.
So you say there's a spin gap in that phase?
At zero temperature, yes. Yes.
But so then I don't understand how you can get a Fermi surface, because if I'm
that's why I said it's fuzzy.
No, but it would seem if I looked at low energy below the spin gap.
So these are these spinless fermions whose fuzzy Fermi surface I'm showing. So you'd have to convolute it with the spin on. That's correct.
Okay, so if I did photo emission below the spin gap, I would see nothing.
You would see a gap. That's right. But I'm trying to apply this as a strange metal where all of these spins are overdamped anyway.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you ever saw this at high field or low temperature, there's no question, you could easily tell.
Yeah.
And no one's ever seen it. Uh-huh. Sure.
Check one more thing.
Yeah.
Which is, so if I have an emergent, so you're having now three emergent gauge fields in the spectrum?
That's right. They're all gapless.
So they come with three conserved currents, in a sense, like the Sturmian current being conserved as the source of those chirality gauge fields?
I don't think so.
There's no analog of that for SU2. So the gauge flux is, you're thinking of the gauge flux, which is that current, the K1 case. But for SU2, that's not gauge invariant.
I think you can write monopoles just even smoothly without singularities, right?
Or whatever. I'm sure it's connected to that.
Let me ask a different question, which is, if I'm thinking, I first need to get some order parameter developing. And on top of that, I'm going to measure a more subtle property of the background. It doesn't have chirality. In this case, it doesn't have something else. It seems somehow that should be an operator which is subdominant compared to the issue of whether you have order in the first place. But the background is traveling in a patch where it's sensitive to precise topology of the spin configuration.
So there's certainly some very non-subtle topological type correlation function you can imagine, I'm sure. I'm not sure people are interested in this, even though I am. I'd love to discuss it with you. I think there are other much more gross features that, suppose you saw pockets without spin density wave order, then you know your things like this that you could easily tell.
My point is actually simply to suggest that would tend to make it weaker and then you have to get something else. So relatively high temperature stuff that tends to make it, since you were saying it might be an exponentially strange balance.
It's a regime where you've got some well posed strongly coupled gauge theory, and there's a physical way of getting it, I think. There's no obvious order parameter, so here's a candidate. I guess the reason I brought this up is, you made the point that, it has to occur through hotspots or doubly critical. In fact, what happens is that, yes, it's doubly critical, but it happens in two steps in this theory. Yeah.
I've got a question from Joe.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. This was a question about gauge invariance in the field strengths. I mean, what you do have with SU2 is a Wilson line. Presumably, in this case, where you expect the gauge field to emerge, you can identify a lot of some kind of gauge invariant non-local, semi-local operator like that.
Sure. Yeah.
And when you fill SU2, you go around twice, so it becomes trivial. So you have these things.
That presumably corresponds to something typical here.
The answer to the question, what is the gauge field in terms of fundamental variables?
Okay. Well, anyway, so the one message, I guess, there's been a long history, especially in the heavy fermions, of people saying, well, we want to understand this transition, and there is some alternative to the Hertz-Millis theory, and you're going to get a direct transition where the pockets are suddenly going to jump a lot. And anyway, so that's mainly been the context of DMFT, and part of the purpose of the work was to look at that in a more field theoretical perspective. And we really allowed for all kinds of fractionalization and in the end, when we found a direct transition, it was back to the old theory. So maybe we need to understand the old theory better. Okay.
All right.
Anybody else on the quantum particle side
would
like to discuss
that? So, going back to quantum particles, so the issue is, can we really have by looking at this funnel? If we are seeing quantum criticality, or we are seeing something. Because the only signature is the linear resistivity and other things.
Well, right. So, that, you know, some of the discussion that Subir sparked on, you know, what is actually happening at the Fermi surface was an attempt
to. These are low temperature signatures.
Right, right.
So these are the stuff that goes up to, you know, 10,000 units.
Right.
Not 10,000.
Well, no. Okay. Well, the bulk weight is 10,000 units. Right. I mean, for example, they throwing bombs. The counter argument would be this calculation that Levine, Lavinesi, and David Hughes did. Mm-hmm. Where they calculated what is it in the high temperature regime of the Hubble law for temperatures high compared to J but low compared to the boundary,
right.
They get numerically.
No.
Was it?
Sorry, unfortunately not. It was for temperatures high compared to the bandwidth but low compared to U.
Right.
Sorry, you're right. Absolutely. Yes. Right. I got it wrong. Okay, but still, they have this regime where the.
Well,
resistivity was linear. I mean, they couldn't go to lower temperatures for numerical reasons.
So. That's a single band model. There's other bands, and once you're up above the bandwidth.
Sorry?
I said that happens in a single band model, yes. Right? But
there was an
here
issue where they couldn't go below
that. Uh-huh. But they are above the divided temperature of the magnets, so it's not surprising.
Well, also, I think
any material above.
No, but in the cuprates, when you
it's not that. It's not that. I mean, it's a completely non-Boltzmann regime. There are no quasi-particles.
Right.
There's no scattering rate. Right. It's just the first term in the high temperature
theory. The question is that.
So it's interesting,
right.
But.
That's an alternative.
Yeah,
what
but the trouble is that here, sometimes, like in lanthanum, neodymium, strontium, copper oxide, and whatever, 24% in a magnetic field, you see the T-linear resistance go down to 10 millielectron volts, or, I mean, 10 millidegrees or something like that.
But in those cases, it only happens at one critical doping. Right?
I understand.
In the case that it goes down to low T, it's evidence that it's got to do with some point.
Right. No, but that's the strongest argument against the high temperature explanation,
right.
Sure, is
right.
That at least sometimes it goes down to really, really low temperature.
I mean, my point is that if we want to ascribe this to quantum criticality, we need to find a better signature and say it's linear T.
No, I think a full explanation, you'd certainly like to see more than one thing. All right, so maybe from bottom up, we'll switch to top down.
Just one comment.
Yep.
There's a question of Doug where, you know, how high can it go? In some ways, it's a quantitative question. I know two calculations that address this. One is with the Heisenberg model, it's a calculation by Subir Kasavarkar, actually also non universal model. When you get linear or quantum critical linear up to G over 2.
You mean the correlation length, or?
But no, that doesn't answer that. Because the point is that there, as you go down in temperature, the spin correlation length is going like 1 over T. So you would see the quantum criticality directly in the magnetic susceptibility. It would be a large and very peaked in Q space.
No, but
doesn't need to be really peaked, actually. It just needs to.
It is. So at J over 2, the correlation length is like 2. No, it isn't. You know, so we're going from 1,000 Kelvin to 100 Kelvin. So it means that the correlation length has grown by an order of magnitude. So the correlation length is 20 lattice constants. Okay, that would show up like a light in neutron scattering.
So what? Come on. So in these materials, like the medium material you mentioned, where it goes down to where it goes deep. In those cases, you see it in the neutron scattering.
At low temperature, I agree with you. So there you do. But in the strange metal regime from 100 Kelvin to 1,000 Kelvin, don't see any magnetic correlations that grow, you know, where their correlation length grows by a large amount. I mean, to be in the quantum critical regime, to get these scaling, you know, the zeroth order thing is it's in the correlation function of the
right.
of the order parameter that's going critical. So in that lanthanum-neodymium case, you see that directly,
right.
but only at low temperature. So, you know, there's no doubt there's a quantum critical point there, and you see it directly.
So one out of that is that, okay, there is a quantum critical point, and very low temperature is controlling everything. But maybe that when you raise the temperature, the crossovers are far more complex than the canonical phase diagram that you understand. There could be a lot more going on. You could start seeing effects of some other phases nearby.
Yes.
In a way we don't understand.
You lose the beauty of the quantum critical point,
well,
which is somehow supposed to give us an explanation that reaches
Well, okay.
It reaches over a short distance. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the trouble is if it tries to reach up to 1,000 Kelvin.
Well, so it's the bottom-up approach, I guess. You understand it as you go up and then go back to phase diagram and see what else is nearby. That will give you a guide on how to keep going up. Okay, that's the one. Of course, it'd be great if it was the simplest thing for it.
All right. So switch to top down. So. Mark says he's got his code, he has an approximation, he runs it, and out comes, he showed us a Fermi liquid Z, and you also said something about resistivity. I don't know if you'd like to repeat that in terms of the central fact. So how much of the phenomenology that we want to understand do you think, would you say, comes out of what you do?
So we've not calculated the resistivity with this particular code. What I was talking about was the resistivity you get from dynamical mean field. That was your
mm-hmm.
question.
Mm-hmm.
In this code, we've calculated things like the energies and the specific heat and the Z. And there we find that at least up to T in the model, we get this marginal Fermi liquid behavior above the quantum critical point, which is
T in this case being hopping.
The bandwidth, yes.
And that's for
this would be 1/8 of the bandwidth.
That's correct, 1/8 of the bandwidth, correct. And we do when we go to larger values of U it seems to increase, but I don't want to say how much, maybe 2T. Mm-hmm. And in that case it clearly seems to be due to this incipient phase separation.
Mm-hmm.
We can actually see, we can actually push the system into a regime where there is a second order transition, it's a terminus of the line of first order transitions, and we can drive that second order transition to zero temperature by changing the model parameters. That's our quantum critical.
Okay, so your claim would be that you can then see from 3000 Kelvin all the way down to zero.
Well,
seemingly
zero.
Well, in the case in the calculation that you're doing,
100 degrees Kelvin.
100. Okay. No, but you say you drove it to zero temperature, you made it quantum critical. I meant in the same sense, right? So the superconductivity is gone, and you're attributing it to this new quantum critical point because
we see when we change the model parameters, we can move the place where we see Z go to zero around.
Mm-hmm.
And the this charge fluctuation, this enhanced charge fluctuation, mm-hmm. is drawn around with it. So we see this.
But does the power law moves around with it? Well,
the
logarithm and Z, the thing that.
We don't get power laws.
No. The log and Z.
We enhance susceptibilities and things like that.
But
we can fit them to power laws.
Yeah.
So can you.
So my question was the following, which is so for those of you who didn't. Follow Mark's. Weren't at Mark's talk. I will proceed to misrepresent it.
Do you want me to misrepresent it?
Well, let me try, and then you can stop. So I think you would say that you've got a. Let's say I do it as a function of chemical potential, right? By suppressing superconductivity, you can get a phase diagram where there is a. Let me first draw one, which would look like a critical endpoint. A first-order phase transition from an insulator, this is temperature, from an insulator to a metal, and then maybe if we put superconductivity back in, we might get something that looks like that.
Right, and right? We can drive that
we
critical
can drive
point
that,
to zero
right.
by changing our T prime.
Okay, so there goes the critical
next
point.
Next near neighbor hopping.
Right, and at that point, the idea would be somehow this could be surrounded by the dome. Right.
Or maybe if you draw a T prime as a, another axis coming.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
I drew two pictures. That's about all I can do.
But you didn't label them.
Oh, well.
So.
Okay.
The doping T prime key, see something like this. This is projection to zero temperature of the second order point. And here's the actual second order that we see. And out here, the behavior, whether it intersects this axis or whether it avoids the axis, it depends upon you. So let's just put a question mark down here.
What's that axis?
T prime.
T prime.
Okay.
Sorry.
And delta is mu?
Yeah,
delta is doping.
Yeah, this is doping. So, and then if we look.
What is zero T prime? What is zero T prime?
Right.
This is there.
Right there, that okay.
So this is the wrong sign of T prime.
Okay.
For the kukrates. And we can move this around by injecting photons into the system. So if I were to look at this in the zero temperature plane, I would see something like this. This is our second order point. This is the region of phase separation. And then at zero temperature, you know, the region of first order extends out to a little bit further, exaggerating this. So really, this is just the liquid gas mixture.
Sorry, let me draw mine again and just ask you the question there. So if I look at the specific case of the T primes picked so that your critical point is at zero, right?
That'd be T prime.
D now or mu, right, right. So here, in the calculation, the superconductivity is gone. And now the statement is what? As I come down, I would see the logarithmic behavior of a marginal Fermi liquid in Z all the way down.
Okay. That's our best guess.
That's your best guess. So then you're attributing this to this with all the usual caveats about quantum criticality because you can see a single
we are coming from top down
all the way down. Okay. All right.
Can I come to the board?
Absolutely.
So,
would you like this too? Here.
So, I think so far all my comments have been about strontium ruthenate, and so I'm going to make another comment about, oh, that's some list you want to keep. I'll come over here. Subir, I'm afraid I'm going to erase the bottom of your phase diagram.
It's pretty fuzzy anyway.
So I want to tell you about strontium ruthenate, but neither the strontium ruthenate that Mac mentioned, which is the nearly cubic ferromagnet, nor the single layer strontium ruthenate that I mentioned, which is the P-wave superconductor, but the bilayer strontium ruthenate. And this does have, as a material, one advantage over the cuprates in that it is a stoichiometric material, and it's, with enormous effort, been made enormously clean. And this has a phase diagram that's very reminiscent of this, although the names of the actors are changed a little. So as a function of temperature and B, Shri here?
He's coming.
Ah, okay, good. So Shri talked about this, and if I screw this up, he'll, I hope, ruthlessly correct me. But so there's a metamagnetic first-order transition. So this is analogous to the liquid-gas transition, except that it's not the density that's jumping across this line, but the magnetization. There's no broken symmetry, but the magnetization is small on this side of the line, and it's large on this side of the line. And again, there's a... No. So I'm about to add another axis, which is the angle that B makes with the axis, which I guess is going to be analogous to this axis. And so this actually here
is the angle between B and the ruthenium oxide plane. So here I've drawn it for the magnetic field in the ruthenium oxide plane, and out here is where it's perpendicular to the ruthenium oxide plane. And so as Mark drew here, there's a line at zero temperature, there's a line of first order transitions which terminates at a zero temperature quantum critical point, but it's the, you know, it's different from the ones we've been looking at in that it's not a quantum critical point between two phases that are different. And then there's this, okay, I'm very bad at drawing even in two dimensions.
And you still want the same pattern.
What?
You want the same pattern as a perpendicular component because you want to go past the point.
Oh, yeah. Right. Okay. Thank you. That's a better. So there's this sheet of first order transitions. There's this line of second order transitions. It comes down to zero temperature and becomes a quantum critical point here. And that was the case until recently, that this was the right phase diagram. I will correct it in a minute. But before I do that, let me point out that if you come down this axis and measure the resistivity, you see non-Fermi liquid behavior. You see a power law. I think it's 1.2. Is that right? It's close to 1. It's essentially 1. So you see a T-linear or what?
1.
OK. It gives me permission to say 1. One-ish. And so you see this over quite a large range of temperature. Now,
was there some claim? I mean, there is a theory for the metamagnetic quote unquote theory in the Hertz.
There is.
Which apparently is something like that.
Yes. So that's what the paper said. Since I've never understood those calculations, all I can do is quote them. But at any rate, using experiment as instead of theory. This quantum critical point in this system is capable of producing such behavior. Now, in fact, it's even a little bit more amusing because when, okay, now I'm going to, sorry, I have to go to two-dimensional plots. So just looking in this plane. So here's temperature and here's magnetic field. And so here's that critical point. This is B perpendicular. And so here's the region where they see the T-linear resistivity. And then what they discovered to their surprise is at low temperatures, there's another phase here that hides this. Again, the names of the phases have been changed. This is a pneumatic phase, we think. That is to say, it's a D-wave particle hole condensate rather than a D-wave particle-particle condensate. But the phase diagram here looks quite similar. But anyway, the main point I wanted to make was this is an example where this sort of quantum critical endpoint is capable of producing something that resembles the strange metal behavior.
How high is the temperature?
What?
How high is the temperature?
You know, not up to these thousands of kelvins.
But the effect of the dome is what kind of way to make kelvin?
Yeah, so if you erase the M's, it's just fine. I don't know. Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure how far up it goes. I think this is on the order of 10 degrees, and so the pictures they tend to show go up to about 10 degrees. I don't know what happens above that. So neutron scattering has been done in zero field. The neutron scattering in this field has, according to rumor, has been done. But you've seen some data.
I don't think it has been analyzed, and it's not very really
Okay, so one of the questions is, what's certainly true is this phase breaks, spontaneously breaks the fourfold rotation symmetry of the crystal. There is a question about whether it might be a spin density wave, and the rumor is that the neutron scattering has not seen a spin density wave, and that therefore this is really purely a pneumatic. But that was actually not the point of my, you know, what's going on here is this delicate, low energy physics. My point was that there is a high temperature regime above this critical point. That there are two analogies. One is, for sure, something happens in the neighborhood of this critical point. So this critical point turned out to be unstable to the formation of some other form of order. And we can, you know, we can discuss what that form of order is. But that, and that then at temperatures much above the ordering temperature, you see the critical behavior of this rather different type of quantum critical point.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
So think of that critical point at the end point of a first order ferromagnetic condition.
Yeah.
Then the theory for that would have propagated for the bosonic mode associated with the order parameter, the Ising order parameter. Uh-huh. And that has a propagator which is mod omega over Q inverse of.
That's right.
So you just choose a.
Okay. If you just do the canonical order parameter fluctuation theory, at this point, you would get a Fermi surface coupled to some bosonic mode, which has this form, mod omega over Q plus Q squared, and the thing is, this kind of propagator is ubiquitous in many of these critical points we're talking about. It appears the Fermi surface coupled to a gauge field. It appears. If you tune a system for a pneumatic transition in a Fermi liquid, you get the same thing. So
that's great. It just gets us out of
right.
One of the things that at least bothered me and bothered Shibaji,
right.
Which is this is a critical point. It has all that behavior, but
yeah.
It's not the critical point that separates one ordered phase from another, one type of order from another. So the argument that you don't see the growing correlations of the ordered phase no longer upsets me.
But wouldn't you see here fluctuations of the density or something?
Yeah.
So the question is perhaps one is testing the wrong word. You know.
Sorry, Q equals.
Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is that there, even though superficially these critical points look very different, when you look at the underlying theory, we are faced with this very similar sort of strong coupling problem.
So, but in this case, you would expect the stability. So, yeah, but you would expect the stability for this Ising type order parameter to show some kind of scaling.
Well, I think that's what they have looked at the magnetic susceptibility, and that's how they identify the critical point by the behavior of the magnetic susceptibility.
Well, in that case, they identified it just by the jump, by the metamagnetism.
Yeah, so they have met that. That is the.
But then they got into this. But
he's right. Yeah. If you go above the metamagnetic critical point, you see a very big susceptibility. I mean, the jump is an infinite susceptibility.
Right.
So. As you come down toward that critical point, the susceptibility is getting bigger.
So the solution is that the decouplers we have been looking at the right.
Right. So I think maybe.
In this problem, the susceptibility is very easy to measure. It's just ferromagnetism.
Right.
But that's why it's important.
So I think maybe organize some of these thoughts in a general fixed point. So one is I think a good thing about his critical point is that it's sort of between nothing and nothing. So you know it's. The tendency to phase separation.
It's not a different symmetry.
So that's nice. The other possibly good thing is that it's something that, in a sense, could be attributed to T and U without necessarily thinking of J, right? Because phase separation could be driven that, so you wouldn't worry about the fact that you know J had to come in. Okay, so that all of that is good. Now, in fact, you have Coulomb interactions, which will do something. At the very least, it might give you stripiness. It may start to look more like what Sabir's talking about, because it will now be the end not of a first-order liquid-gas line, but something involving ordering. On the other hand, it will then introduce another scale between the very high-temperature behavior and the low-temperature behavior of stripes, and then you might wonder why you don't see a crossover somewhere along there. The final comment I have on it is that he was supposed to be a high energy man, and look what he did. He found a quantum critical point and immediately tunneled his way through to it. It's just absolutely impossible to keep theorists above.
I have a question related to your comment about another scale. Right. Would that really be true if T prime is equal to zero?
But once you put in Coulomb, you're not going to have a liquid gas first order transition, it'll open. So now you'll have something which is terminates, actually won't be even a line.
In some picture, you're going to be looking at an axis, there'll be a region of strikiness or micro-emulsion, whatever you call it, you're going to cross this way. This is actually a Grzowski type causal map. So you're crossing this way, so you're going from a liquid to a gas, but you've got this thing that you're not seeing, which is buried under your axis now. But this has fluctuation that's a finite wave vector.
And supercritical, you mean.
And that's right. And those would then tell me. Maybe with this, which might all becomes a rich category. But it will create a second scale.
And you will have another critical point on the right. No?
Here?
And to the right, between the paramagnet and the striking phase.
A striking mixture of the metal and the insulator. And that now brings translation symmetry. So you can't have a critical endpoint between that phase and some
other. But you will have from the paramagnet going down the top phase.
There's
no problem with the insulator strategy.
Clearly, I can reflect it off.
But that's essentially the wrong group.
It's close to 530.
I have a stupid question. Why do you say anti paramagnetism is not playing a role? My guess is that if I were able to look at the
intervention
intelligently, that I would see my liquid is driven by the desire to gain.
Long range order.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Was this a good point in which the product is?
Thank you very much.
The audience congratulating itself.